This is the On Humans podcast with your host, Ilari Mäkelä. And today's episode is about a very simple idea. It's an idea that has been gaining more and more traction in recent years. And it's the idea of universal basic income, or UBI for short. Now, the actual details of the actual policy vary a lot, but the underlying idea in UBI is always the same. That every citizen or resident should be given some basic amount of income and they need to receive it, whether they work or not. Now, some see UBI as a way to simplify the welfare state and prevent so-called welfare traps. Others see it as the only way to maintain dignity for those soon unemployed by robots and AI. But this is not a policy podcast, and therefore I wanted to dig deeper into the philosophy of UBI, into why it might be more than just an interesting policy suggestion among many. My guest is Carl Widerquist, a political philosopher and economist who has been writing about and campaigning for UBI for decades now. And while many of his writings are about the nitty-gritty detail of making UBI economically viable, Widerquist is also a philosopher who links UBI to a wider political project of creating a free society, a society of genuinely free people. Now, most of us would probably agree that freedom is a good thing, but Widerquist argues that the way we typically think about freedom is flawed, and he thinks UBI could fix that flaw. You'll soon hear why. Now, personally, I have long been interested in the promises of UBI, and so I was eager to talk about it with someone at the very center of the movement that has brought this idea into a contemporary discussion. But there was another reason why I wanted to have Widerquist on the show. His work around UBI has led him into interesting areas in anthropology and political history. And in Widerquist's treatment, this need for UBI has really become a lens by which we can understand large trends in political history, from hunter-gatherer bands to agricultural reforms in early modern Britain. I hope that you enjoyed the conversation. If you do, please consider supporting the show. You can just share it, rate it, or subscribe to it if you haven't done so yet. All of those things really do help. And if you have any thoughts about this or other episodes, feedback, guest suggestions, or you just want to say hi, you can always reach me at makela.ilari@outlook.com. But now back to the show. I bring to you Carl Widerquist. Dr. Carl Widerquist, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So you've been writing about universal basic income now for over 20 years. Why?
Well, I've actually been reading about it since 1980 and started writing about it in the late 1990s. So this is something that has been a big deal to me since I was 15 years old. Initially, I found out about it from a documentary by Milton Friedman, where he had a 10-week television show back in 1980 and had one on how to fix the welfare system. And he talked about something like basic income as a way to streamline and improve and fix and make the welfare system more effective, more cost effective, and less cumbersome. And those reasons weren't really what I thought was most important, but I began to see this as a challenge to both to left and right, is that if we really want to help people, we need to help them unconditionally and stop judging people. All of our efforts to put conditions on helping people are counterproductive. They make it so we help fewer people, and the people that we help them less. Poverty is not a crime, and we do not have a completely fair system. Well, no one will end up in poverty if they do everything right. We're all essentially threatened with poverty if we don't keep doing what the powers that be want us to do, keep working at our jobs. Our default position is return to the state where you have nothing. And that is like holding a threat over all of us who aren't independently wealthy anyway.
Yeah, there's an interesting one actually from Milton Friedman. I remember him saying that the taxpayer, quote, might feel that he has the moral as well as the legal right to see that the money is spent for designed purposes in a welfare state. Quote, but whether he has the right is irrelevant. Even if he has, it seems to me neither prudent nor noble for him to exercise it. Unquote.
And I think it is a quite a good line. But what's also really striking is that Milton Friedman, I mean, he's well known to be quite the kind of godfather of neoliberalism, a very right wing thinker. Mm-hmm. And then it's an universal basic income. You can find writings about it from him. You can find writings from progressive left. And so it has this unique quality of having thinkers from both aisles strongly supporting it. Why do you think that is?
You do from time to time. I think that was stronger in the 1960s and 70s, this support from both sides, than it is now. Back then, people like Friedrich Hayek, Milton Friedman, these major thinkers in the libertarian wing of the right, and many others, were getting onto basic income as a way to streamline and make the welfare system more cost effective. But then I think people on to the right of center became more confident in their ability to just cut the welfare state and replace it with nothing, which is what many of them really wanted, rather than something that's actually going to make it better and make it fuller and make it really work for the people who need it. So there are still libertarians that talk about this idea. There aren't very many conservatives who do. Drawing a distinction between these groups. But now the current UBI movement is much more seen as a movement from the left.
And especially, I guess, the certain kind of, in Europe, I've noticed that it's been often the more kind of green liberal left. And it's often not gained much traction from the more traditional social democratic parties. Why do you think that is? Or is that even an observation that's correct?
Well, that varies a lot by country. But there's a big connection to the green left, because one of the best ways to attack not only climate change, but every form of environmental degradation is to charge people money for pollution. Charge them, and charge them a high amount for pollution. And that will, using this as a tool to discourage pollution. Now you can say, well, if you do that, that's going to be a big drag on the economy if that is all you do, and that is true. But if you take that money that you're charging for pollution, these billions and billions or trillions of dollars that you're going to make from charging people from every form, whether it's greenhouse gases or whether it's fertilizer getting into our groundwater, whatever it is, you're charging them large amounts of money for this, that would be a huge drag on the economy. But if you take all those trillions of dollars that we're making from doing this and you put it back into the economy as a universal basic income, as a dividend for everyone, then what you've effectively done is you have made all the polluting industries more expensive, and you've effectively made all the non-polluting industries less expensive. So there's a big connection there with the green movement, but it's also a movement for people who are individualist and anti-authoritarian but care about each other. A lot of people who will say that they're anti-authoritarian and individualist actually very much, well, I'm just individualist for myself. I really don't care that these other people have any power over their own lives if they're poor or something like that. So it is perhaps less appealing to someone on the left who just wants to rebuild everything on a top-down model. It is one that is clearly redistributing power to every individual, regardless of where they stand, to make the least advantaged person more powerful relative both to industry and to government. In both of those are the two centers of power in the world today: the corporations who control our resources and the governments who make the rules. And most of us have very little individual power against those. You got libertarians say, well, just give more power to the corporations and that'll help everybody. Well, I'm skeptical about that. And then you have certain forms of socialists that go, well, just give more power to the government and that'll help everybody. Well, I'm a little concerned about that too. But if you have people who want to say a truly democratic government with this basic income that's going to empower every individual in case those governments the governments don't do enough jobs to keep powerful people in line, you have this basic income that gives every individual power over their lives. So it's coming from that sort of perspective. If that might, who that's going to appeal to is, often unpredictable in the different political contests.
Yeah. And I want before we end, I do want to at some point get back to the more nitty gritty side of whether there are cases where means testing is better than just unconditional cash transfers, etc. But let's stay on the more philosophical side for now. So you've also drawn a link between universal basic income and freedom, which sometimes people think of as a counterintuitive idea, because the idea is that, well, if I'm free, nobody's going to come and take my money and give it to someone else, especially not unconditionally. But you make the claim that actually, in order for us to live in a truly free society, we need either UBI or something similar to it. Could you go through that argument quickly?
That's something people often say. And it's something that's really based on erroneous view of what freedom is, what property rights are, and where property rights came from. The idea that it's something that was put into our language as propaganda for the support of a very unequal property rights system. But it has really infected a lot of the thinking, where you get very good left of center scholars, such as no less than Isaiah Berlin, one of the greatest 20th century philosophers, falling for this idea when he talks about, he says, when you talk about freedom to people who are poor and starving, is to mock their condition. They can't make use of greater rights until they have more food. And it's like, well, you got to ask yourself, why are they poor and starving? Does it have anything to do with them being unfree? Now, freedom, at least since Thomas Hobbes and John Locke, these big philosophers of the 1600s in England, started writing, freedom has, in these contexts, there's many different ways to talk about freedom. And in these contexts, they've talked about freedom as what's now called negative liberty, freedom from interference by other people.
And this is what Berlin is very famous for, right? This either making or popularizing the distinction between the freedom from and the freedom to, right?
Yes. And I do think the negative concept makes sense if you say the freedom of an individual from interference by other people to do whatever it is they might be able to do. I think that is a coherent definition of freedom, and you can call that negative freedom. Negative in the sense,
nobody's telling us, you know, you cannot do that.
Yeah, all I want is to be left alone. That's negative liberty, or negative freedom. So you take somebody who's, say, born without legs. This person can't walk. They're in a, you could say, in a positive sense, they're unfree to walk. But in a negative sense, they're not unfree to walk, because nobody's interfering with their ability to walk. They simply can't walk. And that, you could say, well, we can get some help for you, but that's giving you a greater opportunity, not a greater freedom from interference. And that's okay. And maybe that makes sense for that person. Maybe we should help that person anyway, even though, okay, it's not a freedom issue if you're defining freedom like this. But then they want to say that the same is true for a poor person. They want to say, well, nobody's interfering with you. You just don't have any money. But of course people are interfering. But to be poor is to lack the legal right to buy access the resources you need to survive. Yeah. Well, you only need to buy access to the resources of the earth because someone else owns them. And you only need to do that because there is a law that says some people own the resources, the earth, and the things that we make out of them, and all property in the world, even your most non-corporeal property is, or your electronic property or notional property, all of it is in part made out of the resources of the earth. And you cannot say this person owns the earth and these people own nothing without interfering with those people. So the people who say that being poor is not being unfree are simply wrong. And some of them we're doing as propaganda, but a lot of people, such as Isaiah Berlin, have fallen for that propaganda. So a lot of my work has been challenging that idea.
Yeah. So let me get this right. So people like Berlin, who I have tremendous respect for.
Yeah, me too. Berlin's great.
Yeah, if anybody listening wants to have a truly enjoyable 6 hours on YouTube, I highly recommend them listening to the Origins of Romanticism or Roots of Romanticism lectures. They are all captured on YouTube, and it's just incredible what an orator and what a thinker.
Wow. I should watch that.
Yeah, they're unfortunately only audio. It's only audio, but I'll promise to send you a link after this, and I'll put it in the show notes for the listeners. But anyway, so the mistake that you're accusing him, I think very convincingly, is to not notice that when a person is poor, especially in a modern context, they're not poor in a sense of nobody's interfering there, just happen to be poor. They are poor because there is a law which says that although there is the supermarket over there, which is all the food that you need, you are not allowed to go in and pick up the fruit.
Right.
That person is allowed to go in and pick up the food because they own what we call private property, which we codify in dollars right. or pounds or whatever. You are not allowed to go in there. And we should notice that that is a certain source of infringement. It's intervention. Whether we say that it's a right intervention or an unjust intervention or a just intervention is another question, but it is an intervention. So it is a question of somebody coming and limiting the freedom of this person.
Exactly. And most of the rhetoric on property rights is trying to justify property rights, but based on its supposed connection to negative freedom, simply distracts from this issue. Pretends this doesn't mean anything. When if you're in a world where you cannot provide your own needs because a government has enforced a property system that gives the resources to some other people and not you, that really affects your freedom. And the people who created the property rights system knew that they were doing that, knew the effect that this would have on the freedom of lower class people. And the lower class people knew it too. And it's not been lost on all philosophers. Thomas Paine made very much a freedom-based argument for redistribution of property back in the 1790s. As did Henry George and some of the early works of Herbert Spencer. And then Herbert Spencer was a 19th century philosopher.
Yeah, quite a questionable character, because he's known nowadays mainly as a social Darwinist who had the rhetoric of kind of, well, the whole process of nature is to get rid of the poor because the poor are the weak and the weak are the unfit. Or this is not his words, but I mean, that's the kind of Spencer you encounter if you just Google quickly.
And he wrote this earlier in his life, chapter one of the first edition of his book, Social Statics. Excellent. It reads like Thomas Paine or Henry George. And he never recanted it. But in later editions of the same book, he left that out. And he stopped talking about it and started talking about all this social Darwinist stuff.
Interesting.
So who is the real Herbert Spencer? I don't know, but he at least he got right. Gerald A. Cohen, who just died about 10 years ago, did a great job of revising this view, followed by Michael Otsuka, who wrote Libertarianism Without Inequality, where he talked very much about this issue that if rules assign property rights to people and not to you, you're very unfree in a very important way. And then I've written several books, I think, taking this idea farther than Cohen or Otsuka.
And is this where UBI comes in? I guess we could see the kind of counter-argument to UBI being that, look, taking some people's money in the form of taxes and giving it to others. Of course, technically, everybody gets the UBI, but because of the way the taxation is progressive that funds it, some people genuinely get it, other people don't. It is a wealth transfer from the rich to the poor. And therefore, some people will come and say, well, hey, hold on, that's theft. That you're taking the money of some people who are hardworking, you're giving it to others who might be lazy. And unlike in the current welfare system, where you at least put some kind of conditions on it, you don't even put any conditions, you're just giving it. So this is a gross violation of justice. And then if I understand right, what you would be saying is that completely misses the point. the true injustice is that we have arbitrarily, violently privatized the Earth's resources in a way that some people don't need to work. They can just own property. Others do need to work because they don't own property. And they will be poor if they don't find a job. And that is the true injustice. And that the only way in which we could possibly justify the situation where we live in is if those who own these privatized resources pay at least something, at least a kind of basic income to those who have been arbitrary and sometimes violently pushed away from that system of privatized ownership. Is that a fair characterization of your argument?
Yes. We're a species that is evolved to depend on the environment, like all other species on this planet. One of the things that makes us different is we're capable of making and enforcing rules about it. Well, if you realize we're all born into this environment and we're all dependent on the environment, there are several ways you can do it that are consistent with equality before the law, with equal rights for everyone. We could maintain the earth as a commons, the way we do the oceans and the air. Nobody owns the oceans. Nobody owns the air. We can all breathe in as we want and breathe out as we want. We share the atmosphere. Well, we could do the same with the land, and a lot of our ancestors did for a very long time. That's one way to divide it fairly. Another way would be to distribute it equally. Okay, well, everybody's going to have an equal share of the resources of the earth. Or we could use it for some joint project if we all agreed to what that project was. But if we couldn't come to an agreement for what that project was, it really wouldn't be fair if some people liked the project and other people hated the project, but we're all working and contributing the same amount and taking the same from it, but some people hate the project. That's not exactly equality before the law. But another way, what I suggest for doing it is you can divide it unequally if those who have more compensate those who have less through taxation of people who own the resources of the earth and a basic income for everyone else.
Well, if we take the argument that the privatization of resources is in some important sense unjust, and it needs to be rectified in some way or another, I think there would be two counterarguments. From the capitalist right, you would hear that no, it's not unjust. There's a logic to it, or at least there could be a logic to it. And then from the more Marxist left, there would be the counterargument that yes, this is very unjust, and therefore we need to get rid of private property altogether. So maybe we can go through these one by one, and I guess we're going to spend more time in the first one because you've written a whole book about it. So maybe we can start with John Locke. John Locke is the thinker that those wanting to justify private property as a kind of fundamentally natural and or just part of a free society would fall back on. So what's Locke's theory about private property?
Locke's theory is even by a lot of people who disavow him as a thinker, is he came up with some of the ideas that are today the core of a response to this idea that it's inconsistent to have some people own the earth and everyone else then dependent on getting jobs for those people who own the earth. And Locke comes along in the 1600s, and he needs to do this at a time. He did this pretty late in history. There are some of the things he says go back to references back to Roman times. But a lot of us knew it needs to be done at this time because Europe is starting to free itself from the idea of the divine right of kings, and that Hobbes was defending the right of kings without saying it stemmed directly from divinity. Thomas Hobbes, the other big philosopher of England in the 1600s, he was justifying, well, whatever the king does is fine. It was, and he had a long book trying to justify why that's true. Locke is trying to say that we need to have at least some kind of democracy, some limited amounts of democracy, and we need to have rights for individuals that even the king or even the assembly of people cannot cross. And one of those, he wants to say, is private property, is that property is a natural right.
I mean, and in a way, this sounds this sounds promising in a way that it kind of...
Well, the idea that we should have some rights that, the government can't redress, and the idea that we should have democracy and we should tolerate each other's, these are all great ideas. And Locke is really important to the expansion of rights. So Locke does have a lot of good ideas, but he wants to justify existing inequalities, as did his predecessor, Thomas Hobbes. Thomas Hobbes did it by referring to why we should all obey the king. Locke wanted to say that property rights, even though they're highly unequal, actually stemmed from equality before the law. And he does it, his argument does it by telling a fairy tale, telling a myth. He creates a myth, and people have been retelling this myth, even people that don't know who Locke is, or people who know who Locke is and don't really like him other than that he was for property, have been retelling this myth ever since, to the point where people actually believe this is true, that this is where property rights came from. And his myth, Locke's myth, is that property is created by the original appropriator, a man, and for Locke it would have been a man, but or a family, whatever, goes into a virgin wilderness and chops down the trees and plows a field where the trees had been and builds a house, and thereby makes this forest that produced very little, it's going to produce much more. So this person has gone into the wilderness and mixed his labor with the land, and that means that if we all agree that we all own ourselves, well, now that this guy has put himself into the land in a way that makes the land more valuable, then this person should own this land. And besides, he's done it in a way, by making it more valuable, he's argued that's also going to make everybody better off because we're producing more. And Locke goes so far as to say that even the lowliest day laborer in London is better off, in London of his time in the 1600s, is better off than one of those naked savages in America at the time. That's Locke's theory. Now, remember where we started. I was arguing that the property rights system we have makes people unfree because it interferes with their most basic functions in life if they have no property. It frees up property owners by interfering with everybody else. And that's not just people at the very bottom end. If you got a good job and a mortgage, you might think of yourself as a property owner. But if you stop working, you wouldn't be able to pay that mortgage. You'd be sooner or later, if you just stop working for people who have more than you do, you would sooner or later be out of a job, be out of a house and on the street. I'm talking about the 99% of the people. If you do not work for banks, clients, landlords, and bosses, even if you're so-called self-employed, you're going to be on that street.
Then importantly, you will be on the street which doesn't have access to any hunting grounds, any foraging grounds, which used to be the case for humans.
Right. You don't go back to hunting and gathering or subsistence farming, nor to fishing. And most of the world, this happened in the few hundred years. You can go to some parts of the world where it happened earlier, but most of the world sort of happened. So so I'm addressing this Lockean defense of this unequal system. And Grant McCall, who is an anthropologist, he and I have written two books on this topic, debunking ideas connecting with this view of property. The first one was called Prehistoric Myths and Modern Political Philosophy, and the second one was called The Prehistory of Private Property. And so after I told Locke's theory, I could have really just kind of launched into giving a lecture on these two books, but I thought I'd pause to get you back in the conversation. So where do you want to go with this?
Well, let's focus on Locke's theory about this is the origin of private property. So there is some kind of just, or at least plausibly just, backdrop, which is that those who were able to mix their labor with the land, those that were able to go to the woods and carve a spot for themselves, are those who rightfully own it. And this is where all private property originally stems from, is just the fact that we acknowledge that those that worked for something deserve the fruits. Is that right?
On that little issue of people being better off, that's the first book, Prehistoric Myths, and attacks this issue that it doesn't matter that everything's unequal because we're all so much better off because we put this system in place. Grant McCall and I, in our book, Prehistoric Myths, have loads of data showing that this is simply false. A lot of us are better off, but the poorest among us are worse off. But now, this argument, so Locke tells this fantasy story about this original appropriator, and everybody knows that the Rockefeller fortune does not, and Elon Musk's family's diamond fortune, and Elon Musk's family did start with diamonds in South Africa. He's added to it, give him some credit there, but these fortunes, everyone knows that these fortunes don't stem from an original appropriator like Locke talked about. So why do they keep telling the story? Why is it for over 300 years people have been retelling this story about the original appropriator when we know that the property owners today don't have an unbroken chain to it? And what they're and I go through some of the rhetoric of hundreds of years of people talking about this, Grant and I do. And show that what they're really trying to show with this is that there's something natural about the private property system, is that when people are free from interference, this is what they want to do. They want to establish property by working with the land, making a claim on it, and making it property. This belongs to me or me and my family. That's how property begins, and we get these other systems because powerful people interfere with them and start messing things up. So even though we don't have an unbroken chain, the faults in that come from governments who are interfering with individuals as they want to do this. You say, okay, well, now that's a pretty strong empirical claim. Is that what people want to do? You certainly have in American history, you certainly have some white settlers doing things that look like this. But they weren't the first people on that land. What do original appropriators really want to do? And that's why I teamed up with an anthropologist, Grant McCall, to look in, well, what really happens? If you look at, in anthropology, what do the original people do? The first people that got to the United States were, what's now the whole of the Americas, and really the whole of the world, were hunter-gatherers, starting in Africa and eventually branching out to the whole world. Before they started farming, they were hunter-gatherers. And virtually all known hunter-gatherers, at least the nomadic hunter-gatherer, all known nomadic hunter-gatherers treat the land as a commons for all to use, but no one to own. So for a lot of criteria, you could get to say that people who treated the land as a commons. But also then, if you go farther, if you look at, what did the first farmers do?
Because many people would come and say that, you'd have this nomadic hunter-gatherer existence, but whether you start farming or things like that, you start having this kind of privately owned land plots, you start having elites appropriate land, perhaps unjustly, but that something like that happens. So in between that past of everybody being hunter-gatherer and 2023, what are we missing if we just jump from nomadic hunter-gatherers to privately owned land?
You're missing an awful lot. What happens with earliest agriculture? Well, the earliest farmers in most places around the world, if not all of them, are Swidden agriculturalists, which is another word for slash and burn. Now, actually, slash and burn agriculture sounds environmentally terrible, but it's actually not. It's not burning on an industrial scale. What it is it's a method of crop rotation. You go into the woods, you burn down the trees that are there in one section of the woods, somewhere in the woods. You burn down the trees that are there. You then from the ash, you make a mulch, and which is very good fertilizer for your crops. You farm there for a few years until you deplete the soil, then you move somewhere else and do the same thing. So you end up with people that have little settlements in a big woods. So they do lots of hunting.
What's different? What's different about it? So when we look at early agriculture, first of all, what of it is not similar to Locke's story, and why does it really matter?
Well, individuals, the individual appropriator that Locke talks about does not exist. Swidden agricultures don't go out there as individualists. You know who goes out as individualists? People who has an army behind them that know when they go out and they take land from Native Americans that they have the British army behind them, and they will be able to sell their crops on a cash market back to London that has a million people and a well-developed economy. That's when you get original appropriators, when they're already part of a trading system. But when you get the original agricultures, if you do not have a cash economy and you don't have an army and a police force, last thing you want to do is go out to the woods by yourself, unless you're unless you got some sort of a personality.
I remember actually when I was young, when I was a high school student, and I learned about Locke and Rousseau and Hobbes and everything about state of nature, all of this state of nature stuff. It did almost always strike me as funny just how much the assumption seems to be that you have these individuals kind of going around the woods, almost like bumping into each other in a clearing and being like, oh, there are other of us, you know, instead of what obviously took place, which is that we're a social animal. But that said, David Hume is famous for saying that very point and saying that, well, it's not like this thing actually went in the way that people like Locke would say, but this is a philosopher's thought experiment that we can nevertheless use to poke at some intuitions. What do you think of Hume's point that, well, you know, the facts don't really matter, this is all just a thought experiment?
That's the difference between what I call a constructive and a destructive myth. Thought experiment that reveals an underlying truth is a very useful myth. But one that illustrates a lie is a destructive myth. So what I'm trying to say that Locke's appropriation story is a destructive myth because it illustrates this lie that makes you think of property rights as something that are naturally individual. But when you look at what the original appropriators do, it's very different.
And but what about those who would say that, well, but it's not such a big difference because, okay, it's true that in the original property owners, we might say, weren't quite as individualistic as these pioneers in America from Europe that Locke is thinking about, perhaps. But it was collective ownership. It was collective ownership. And so Hobbes' theory, I think, is something akin to it's the monarch, the king, who kind of owns this collective land and then distributes it to some, perhaps justly, perhaps unjustly. What about those who would say that, well, Locke is telling too neat of a story, but there is a story to be told, which is that anybody who wants to respect, for example, indigenous rights nowadays has to have some kind of a conception of some people somewhere owning a bit of land. This land belongs to these indigenous people, for example. We need to respect the fact that they have ownership to the land. So there is this idea of ownership of the land, even if it's communally owned, collectively owned. And then if you have that, then you can get to a modern property right regime by just saying that, well, when you have a huge rise in population density, whatever, the community can decide that the best way to organize this land is by chopping it into private properties. You get productivity gains, as you did in England during the enclosure movements, etc. And you kind of go from the idea of some group owning land to a modern property rights regime. Maybe in a Lockean fashion, maybe not in a Lockean fashion, but what would you say to someone who takes that path?
Okay, you said a lot there. A lot I need to address there. One is that nomadic hunter-gatherers who've been studied for throughout recorded history, and especially in the period when most of the land was being stolen, the nomadic hunter-gatherers are very individualistic in one sense, in the sense that they respect everybody as an individual and that they shouldn't have to follow orders from another individual, but not individualistic in the sense of property. Their idea of individualism is everybody's free to go out there and hunt and gather on the land. Every individual, no other individual can tell them you can't do that. Now, this varies. There are some that will say, well, you got to be a member of our tribes to do it here. But very often, even in the nomadic tribes that will do that, if a nearby tribe comes and asks for permission, they're not really in a position to say no. If they've come and they've asked nicely, you've really got to let them, or you're going to be inviting some sort of a conflict. But there are some, such as the nomadic Inuits, those Inuits who are nomadic, will tend to say, if you want to go there and, you know, hunt seals and compete with the polar bears up in this land we live in, have at it. You don't have to be an Inuit. You don't have to be native. Anybody, this land belongs to everyone in the world.
But this is very important, actually. The detail here is important because the details, as far as I know them, is that the more you get population density, the more you start to having territorial behavior in a way of having more strictly defined areas. And that you could see this as a kind of neat progression from having very low population density, everybody moves around, to very high population density. You have to make tough choices on how a group manages its land. And the one way the group manages its land is that it divides it into privately owned segments and wage labor, as happened in England during the enclosure movement.
Well, it's a big jump to go from saying denser populations need more rules to therefore it's okay if the denser populations have rules that say, oh, the king and the lords own everything and everybody else has to work for them.
Yes.
That's a pretty big jump.
Yeah.
But let me go back to we're at Sweden agriculturalists. What makes the Sweden agriculturalist different than Locke's mythical original appropriator, these real original appropriators, is that they didn't do it individually. They did it as a village. As a village of maybe 300, maybe 600 people, usually not as large as 1,000, not because technically they couldn't get it as 1,000, but it's hard to get 1,000 people to get along. So people go out as a group. They cut down the trees as a group. They create a farming space as a group. But then they say, everybody, whether you helped us cut these trees down or not, everybody, just by dint of being here in the village, gets some land that they can use this season. And then next season, maybe we'll be grazing animals on some of this land or something. Next season, we'll be changing it around. But everybody gets access to this land just dint of their being a member of the group. They get that, and you also get, among low-scale groups, you get very few of them, if any, that view the land as private property or even as group property in the sense that we know it. The idea that native people, that land is something that could be sold or bought, is extremely foreign to most people who would in any way resemble our original appropriators. That idea comes much later in history. So the oldest, what the institutions that the anybody that could be called original appropriators put in place were not private property institutions, but land tenure rights that are complex, flexible, overlapping, and at least partly common, where there is a significant amount of land that everyone can use. In Europe, you'll see this as late as before the enclosure movement, when they really started creating the property rights system we have, where you will have villages where there's farming land and they're using crop rotation, so they don't have to move around by Sweden agriculturalists. But then they're surrounded by a forest where anyone can hunt and gather. So they're mostly agriculturalists and they keep land on pastures, but they can also hunt. And that land is a commons. And usually there's a common pasture land in the country. That institution lasts until very recently. You see vestiges of it in Boston Common in Boston and in Sheep Meadow in Central Park in New York. These used to be places where the common people were free to come and graze their animals. That's long been enclosed. People have long lost their rights to do, but that's where these came from. These ideas that there should be land for all to access and none to own. And the idea of one of these tribes being like selling their land for cash to another one is anathema to most of them, which is why it was so easy for white settlers in the Americas to cheat natives out of their land, because they were usually dealing with somebody who wasn't actually the head of the group, and paying him off, and then having him say, "Oh yeah, I'm the chief of this group, whatever you mean by chief, that's me. I have the right to do this. You give me this money, and this is yours." Not really understanding what that meant, and doing this over and over again, saying, "No, we bought your land." And even when they conceded the land, they usually cheated on that. So it's very easy to cheat people when you've got an idea that land ownership is like this and it's only this way, and they've never thought of treating land like that at all. And that's how a lot of the land in the world became private property.
Would it be right to then say that the big picture, as much as we can summarize it, is that we have this nice Lockean myth that the reason some people have resources, they can just live off their resources, and other people have to work in order to live, is because originally somebody in the family lineage or something went and appropriated that bit of land that became the property, etc. And that's not the case, but what's the case is that actually we start from this whole world being a kind of commons. Yes, people can be poor, but they always have the access to the means of food production. They can always go and try, and always try and go to forage. Then you get a kind of more communal agriculture, which becomes the norm before this enclosure movement.
Well, property begins with the top down. It begins in some ways much, much earlier than the enclosure movement. What you get gradually when you have these agricultural societies, these small-scale independent villages, gradually, as they get denser, you get chiefs raising armies and collecting villages together and pointing themselves head and taking on extra powers for themselves, and these grow into kingdoms. And the earliest kingdoms, it appears, again, it's very foggy of what's happening in prehistory, but it appears if you look back in the oldest records, you get the least private. You have a king who is a representative of, who is at least portrays himself as a representative of the people. But you get property beginning very often from the top.
Land property, right? We're talking specifically.
Yeah, land property. Once they say, yeah, everybody owns their clothes or something like that. But even those kind of institutions don't begin from the first person to make a spear is not necessarily the owner of that spear. In a lot of groups, if you got two spears and you make two spears, yeah, and somebody else doesn't have one, and that person asks to borrow it with not really a strong promise to give it back anytime soon, as long as you have more than you need, you're pretty much going to be badgered to give them that other spear or to stop camping with this group.
Yeah. Which is I think it's an important lesson.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to give a little background connecting these thousand years between that. You get as early as in ancient Mesopotamia and Egypt, you get property, you get something more like private property beginning in the cities, starting from the top down with the king saying, okay, well, this is most of what I have really belongs to I have in the name of the people, but this is mine. This estate is mine. And then, then both of my sons are going to get some estates, even though one of them's king. And, my cousin's going to get some. Oh, and the temples are going to own those privately. It's beginning from the top down, but most of the world by, say, 1500, most of the world, private properties, we know, is really only developed in the cities. Some variation of this village agriculture is still where you've got a core village where the farming is going on, usually surrounded by common land, which is maybe used for hunting or something like that, depending on the type of land and terrain and so forth. Well, many variations went on this, but very often some kind of communal village. But by this time, in most of the world, some sort of parasitic layer of chiefs or lords has been appointed on top of that. And you get that in lots of places.
Well, some people say parasitic, others say important administrators for irrigation or whatever. I think we can be agnostic about it for now.
Well, yes. Yeah. the generally, I would say generally, it's a combination of both. Generally, if you got an administrator up top, very often you need somebody to do something, whether it's to protect you or to arbitrate your disputes or something. But also, if that person is not answerable to the people, and sometimes even if he or she is, if they're not answerable to the people, they will abuse that power and do some things that are parasitic.
Yeah. That's well explained. Yeah.
So you can get this parasitic layer, even if there are some reasons why you do need somebody playing a coordinating role. Yeah. And you get this in a lot of places, but by 1400s, in the 1400s, in most of the world, if they're not still hunter-gatherers, you've got some variation on this village agriculture, but usually with some kind of lord or chief at the top. And then at about that time, two movements begin. Some areas earlier, some areas, going back thousands of years before this. But in a major way, two things begin around the 1400s, what we call the enclosure movement in Europe and the colonial movement everywhere else. And this is really what establishes the private property system. Let's start with the enclosure movement. In Europe, gradually, the chiefs, or the lords, as they would call themselves, were administrators of land that belonged to the village. This land, if there was anyone with any kind of claim to be the original appropriator, has to belong to the peasants.
Yeah.
Because their ancestors have been farming this land for thousands of years. The lord is relatively new. But with the enclosure movement, was the idea of saying that the lord has always been really the true owner of this land. And the peasants have never, as long as they've been working this land, they have never gained rights of ownership of this land.
And I don't think anybody believes that nowadays. But I mean, there is another story to be told, which is that the enclosure movement, yes, does push peasants out of land that they used to nominally own, but that what it was preceded by was a feudal era. Not great for peasants either, not a land of the free. And what emerges out of the enclosure movement is the so-called British Agricultural Revolution, which is this huge increase in productivity. And in a way, I think the enclosure movement is often taught in textbooks, as far as I've seen, as a story moving away from feudalism and towards a more productive era. And so even if it's not that just society that is being created, it is not contrasted to a more just past, because it's a feudal past, and it is a more prosperous society that is created. Yes, you do start getting the urban poor, and therefore you have the poor laws passed in England, which I guess the UBI would in a way be a kind of glorious endpoint. If we were to have a genuine UBI, but what do you think of the point of like, well, it's not really contrasted to a just past, it's contrasted to a feudal past, and that it had so many benefits that we should live with whatever little injustices went into creating it.
Well, that's the parasitic layer that I'm talking about, and that parasitic layer has a lot of variations, and people like, I think it's maybe some propaganda to think about, oh, it was all, we were all peasants were basically slaves under the feudal system. That's just simply not true. There were some like that. You get a big variation of how much this parasitic layer of lords is taking from the peasants. Very often the lords didn't have time or interest to do more than tax the people. The people lived there. They talked out, how are we going to farm this land? And then the lord took 20% of it or something like that. And in that case, you get people who are actually very well-fed, well-housed, and control their own decisions about how they're going to work and what kind of work they do. So being a peasant with this parasitic layer on top of you is not great, and having that low level of technology is not great. But a lot of peasants were, given what technology they have, had a lot of control over their lives that later people don't do. But the thing is, when they ended this system, they did not end it for the benefit of the people. They ended it very much for the benefit of the lords in two ways. They started saying that these that the peasants never had any rights to the land. The peasants are and have always been tenants.
Mm-hmm.
The Lord is the true owner, and what they have to the land is not rights, but traditions.
Yes, I see.
So we can make them wage workers, actually under the command of the owner, and we can make them tenants, and the owner can say, I'm not renewing your lease, you must leave the land. This was done for two reasons. It was done because the lords obviously wanted to be fuller owners of the land they were and to be able to interfere with the peasants in their decision-making. It's done for that reason. But it's also done very explicitly. And in the book, Prehistory of Private Property, we have some quotes from people at the time that they did it because they couldn't get the peasants to work for them. And so one of the reasons that they enclosed the land is they wanted the peasants to charge lower wages for labor. Well, how do you do that? Well, take away their rights to the land, and then they will have to work for the person. So, no, it was not. The end of feudalism and the enclosure movement was not it was not initially a positive step for the peasants of Europe.
Okay, well, fair enough. And we can all agree that the colonial movement on privatization of native lands was not a positive for the native people.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe we can then summarize so far what we talked so far as it's clear that there is a large amount of arbitrariness and injustice going into the situation which we have created, which is a situation where a poor person is not only poor, but is being banned from the many resources that are just next door and are banned from the production of their own food. Mm-hmm. That's not a just story. And therefore, anybody who says that, well, tax is theft, is really starting from the very last mile of the journey. They don't see all the journey taking into a position where you have the people to be taxed.
Yeah. This libertarian idea that taxation is theft is really a revolt of the lords.
Yeah. Now, what about then the Marxist? So the Marxist line here would be to say that you have told in incredibly convincing detail the story of how unjust private property is. And the response to that is to get rid of private property altogether. Why not take that line?
Well, you bring up Marx and you bring up Marx, and just in Marx, you got thousands of pages of his writing, and then millions of pages more of Marxians writing about him. So whatever I say about Marx, my preface is going to be very incomplete. But I think he got a lot of things right about capitalism. When he says the workers are the workers have no power to refuse because they're going to die if they don't, and therefore they accept really low wages and exploitation. I think he's very right about that. But then his solution is to eliminate private property. And then he just goes into a lot of wishful thinking. Marx is a student of capitalism. Marx wrote about early history somewhat, and he wrote a lot about capitalism. And he studied capitalism very closely. And in his whole life, he wrote maybe a dozen pages about what's going to happen, maybe a few dozen, but very, very little about what's going to happen after capitalism. And most of that is wishful thinking. Oh, once you get rid of the private property system and we realize we're all in it together, then power will lose its political character and we will all share and share alike. And that's not what happened. That was a very naive idea. You can get rid of the private property system and create some other new power structure, and people will exploit that one too. And the Soviets did get rid of private property, but they were like one giant private property owner that owned the whole of the Soviet Union and exploited the whole of the workers of the Soviet Union in a way, a more hierarchical system than capitalism, where at least you've got several different corporations you can work for. In the Soviet system, you just had one, and it was controlled by people. At least during Stalin's period, by someone who didn't mind making everyone suffer. So I do find some of Marx's complaint correct. I find some of it incorrect. But his solution is not the right solution because it doesn't empower the people as individuals. You need democracy where people are living under the laws that they and their neighbors think are reasonable. And then you need something like basic income. If you don't have subsistence farming or access to hunting and gathering grounds, you need something like basic income. So every individual says, I'm not going to do stuff until you make it worth my while. That's how you empower. That's how you empower the disadvantaged. Marx wanted to do that, and he didn't know how because there was no communism to study.
Fascinating. Then before we end, let's cycle back all the way back to where we started from, which is UBI as a policy suggestion. Basically, what we've talked about so far is the need for redistribution so that everybody has enough. They have enough in a sense that they are not being poor just because we say that they are not allowed. The government, the rules, the system says that they are not allowed to access the resources that are right next door. But why UBI instead of Nordic welfare state?
Well, the Nordic welfare state is conditional. It's very generous.
Everybody gets something. Everybody gets something. There is a payment that everybody has access to if they don't get any of the other payments, but the exact amount you end up getting is conditional to all sorts of questions like whether you are searching for work, how long have you been unemployed, etc.
Well, that's something that's moving in the direction of basic income. But once you say, okay, we're only going to give this to you if you're looking for work. And it's conditional. You got to be looking for work. Either that you're looking for work thing is fake. And really all you got to do is say, oh, yeah, I'm looking for work. And that would make it really a fake requirement. Or you're going to leave some people out. If you're going to have a conditional program and the conditions are real, then they have to have real punishments. Either you're going to jail the people who don't comply, or they're going to become homeless. The homeless rate is very low in the Nordic countries, but it's not non-existent. And they waste a lot of time and effort getting people to comply with these conditions and respecting them less. I mean, one of the things about UBS, it's really about respect. It's not about trust. Oh, I trust that if I give you this money, you're going to go get a job anyway. No, I respect that if you say the jobs all suck, maybe they do all suck. I don't know your situation. And I know it certainly is possible to have a country where every single job that you can get sucks, and maybe we shouldn't be asking you to work. That's what I mean by respect rather than trust. And that's what I think
in Finland actually
there. Well, Finland is the closest to this model we have, except for maybe Iceland or Norway. It's one of the three best in the world, but it's still not far enough towards that true respect for the least advantaged. That I think a really
yeah, good and it is very bureaucratic in a way that leads people who get basically free money from government feeling
really
suffocated in a way that from the outside you might be like, well, hold on, getting money, like why, you know, it's much better than anywhere else. but you know, the interesting thing that happened when Finland became the first country to have a state-sanctioned universal basic income experiment. And it was a very low UBI. This was not enough to sustain properly.
Yeah. The first one since 19.
Oh, yes, because US had four negative income tax experiments, right? And Canada had.
Yes, and Canada had one.
Yeah. But when Finland did this recently, it was done. The two interesting points for me when I was reading about this was, first of all, it was done by a center-right government. In order to kind of get more bang for the buck. The idea was to move into a less government, like less heavy government apparatus to help people at the bottom. But the second thing that was really interesting was that in the data, one thing that was apparently a disappointment was that people didn't seek employment less. They might have even seeked employment a little. Sorry, they didn't seek employment more. They might have seeked employment a little bit less, which some people hope they will seek more of it because now you don't lose the money immediately if you get a job. But what did happen was that people felt much more respected, like you said. People felt much more creative. They felt more confident. And they felt more trust to the system. And I think that's a very, very valuable thing to cultivate. Confident people who have trust in the system.
We immediately, when the way we treat disadvantaged people is just so backwards. It is a person has nothing. They need help and they go to the government. The government says, well, what can you do for us? The first question, what can you do for us? Can you get a job? Are you capable of getting a job? Okay, prove to me you can't get a job. Prove to me you've looked for one and can't find one, or prove to me you're disabled and can't get one. If the person who supposedly wants to help you, their first question is always, what can you do for me? Why should that person trust you at all? We don't, we think about what are the disadvantage have to do to earn our trust. We need to be thinking, we've created a country where we are advantaged and these other people aren't. How can we earn their trust? We earn their trust by sharing with them unconditionally, realizing we didn't create a perfect meritocracy. The reason some people are rich and you're poor is not because they've done everything right and you've done everything wrong, that it's all about merit. If it's not about merit, if you know that there's injustice anywhere in this system, then help people and help them unconditional. And that's how you show respect for them. And by showing respect for them, you earn their trust. If you do the opposite, you say, when we ask for this, okay, we're gonna give you stuff, but first you give us stuff, the advantaged people, that promotes selfishness. It's supposed to the opposite of what they think it will promote. They think that will show people you should never take something without giving back. But what it actually promotes is selfishness. It promotes never give unless you get something back. The people who get those things, you give them this make work and make them do something or make them prove that they can't work, that you're inviting them to say, I will, this system, when I needed something, this system asked me what I could do for the people who are already advantaged. They never gave me nothing. I will never give anything to anyone else. The system promotes selfishness because the authority behaves selfishly. If you want to promote unselfishness, you've got to behave unselfishly. You promote by example. You promote by the example you set, not by what you force other people to do.
And what would you say to those who see not accepting a job? I guess we all know that there are situations when you're a caretaker, for example, of someone close by, whether a young infant or a sick parent or something. There are cases where there are good reasons not to accept a job. But when people say that, well, none of these jobs are great, I don't like the modern economy, I don't want to participate in this deal, I would much rather have just a nice lump of money on my bank account. Some people would say that this is a form of kind of something between social myopia and ingratitude, because all the food that you want to buy with that money, all the shelter you want to be in, was made by someone. There were farmers who farmed that food. There were workers who worked in a very dangerous environment to build that house for you, to put that insulation in. There were architects drawing it so that it's not going to collapse on you. And you don't want to give anything back? Okay, if you're unemployed because you're searching for a job and you can't find one, fine. If you're looking after an elderly parent, okay, fine. But if you just don't want to accept a job and you want to go surf instead, well, that's just a lack of gratitude. What would you say to that? Because that is something that you hear against kind of generous UBIs.
That argument ignores what the disadvantaged of the world have already given. They've already given, without lifting a finger, they have given because they have less than everyone else.
I'm talking about people like me and my friends. You know, 30-year-old, you have a university degree. Instead of deciding to contribute into the economy, you would much rather get an unconditional lump of money and go to do a backpacking trip and hiking. I'm not, for example, me or my friends, we are not an example of the deeply disadvantaged. We are not example of people in the brink of poverty, but we are people who might really prefer the unconditional cash transfer and not wanting to work. And some people see us as the problem and the reason you need to have conditional cash transfer so that people who are genuinely disadvantaged, people who are genuinely struggling with poverty, get the money, and people like me or my friends don't get the money.
Well, there's two things I like that. Conditional programs are not good for the genuinely disadvantaged. Conditional programs always end up treating them like criminals, always under judgment, always under suspicion, always being told you didn't do this, you didn't do that, you need to fill out this new form. Unconditional is better for the truly needy. I've got a new book coming out called Basic Income, Essential Knowledge, where I get into this issue quite a bit. So it's not better for the truly needy. But let's take somebody, say, 28-year-old with a good education. Maybe you're eligible for an $80,000 a year job. And you'd rather earn an 80,000 euro a year job.
80,000 would be a hugely optimistic suggestion for most of my friends, I have to say, but 30,000.
And you're also eligible, and you've also got a 20,000 euro basic income, a very generous basic income, 20,000 euros a year, and you decide to live off of those 20,000, the person on basic income is consuming much less, and they're building up much less ownership of the wealth of this world. So they're contributing by being the lowest consumer. If you have a basic income and you live off of that basic income, whether you have other opportunities or not, you have joined the group who are tied for owning the least, using the least, and using up the least of our resources and our productive base. You're not doing work, but you're making resources available for others. All of those people, all of those goods that you're buying are made by people who are work and who are paid for their work. And because they're paid for their work, they are either accumulating wealth or they're consuming more than you are. They're consuming things made out of resources that take that are a command on the environment that we all depend on. So what you're doing, what you're doing, your reward is, it's a passive reward. You are making do with less to free up the resources to reward people to do these jobs. We've already taken from the least advantaged. We have not given them back. And then suddenly what I want to say, now you've got to give back. No, it is the advantaged people's turn to give back first. They're the ones who have not given back. They need to give back to the people who simply have less.
We are approaching the end of time. So before we finish, one last question. During all the work that you've done on philosophical anthropology, or more generally that you've done, right, researching, campaigning, how has all that work shaped of humanity, of our species?
We, and including me, none of us are as rational as we think we are. We're constantly thinking and attempting to use valid reasoning, but we're not as good as it we think about. We don't know to the extent that we're driven by our emotion, and so we're overconfident. We're overconfident that we know the right thing. And that's why people who have advantages have to be really kind to people who have disadvantages. Because we're very likely to make mistakes. And we're likely to make mistakes in a systematic error. Mistakes that are good for us. So we've got to really go over the top and say, I'm going to try to impose as little as I can on everybody else, that nobody's going to go below this level, because I'm really not that good in figuring out what is the right, just, and true thing in every occasion. Just got to make sure everybody's safe, everybody's got to have access to what they need to survive, and everybody's got as much freedom as we can get them. That, I think, is the view, you're asking my broad view of humanity that I've taken from this study. I guess that's my best way to sum it up.
Carl Weidequist, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. And thanks for those questions. That was covered some topics that I've done before, but in a different way because of the way your questions were drawing them. So I really enjoyed that a lot.
This was the 19th episode of the On Humans podcast. If you enjoyed it, you might also want to check out episode 15, where I dig deeper into the history and philosophy of political equality with philosopher Elizabeth Anderson. Or if you want to hear about the brighter side of modern political economy, at least post-1870s, you might enjoy episode 18 with economic historian Brad DeLong. Anyway, I hope that you are or will be a subscriber and tune in next time. Until then, take care.